Once upon a time in America, children in school took part in regular fire drills and something else, too, air raid drills. Older baby boomers can remember being told to duck and cover in cheery informational films along the lines of, when you see the white flash of a nuclear weapon, get under something that can protect you from the flying glass. Well, the drills ended, and our fear of imminent nuclear war appears to have subsided, especially since the Soviet Union collapsed a quarter of a century ago. But the weapons still exist, and for many people, the fear still exists. Danzak writes of both in his book Almighty, Courage, Resistance, and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age. Danzak is a general assignment reporter for the Washington Post, meaning he can be sent to cover just about anything. And his list of places reflects that. Baghdad, Newtown, Connecticut, and Hollywood appear on the list. Almighty is his first book, publication date tomorrow. Congratulations and welcome to the Jefferson Exchange, Danzak.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Did you run across this story and the players while on assignment for the Post?
No, it kind of came across my desk by happenstance. I didn't even know of this break-in. These three activists broke into a nuclear weapons facility in East Tennessee 4 years ago this month. I didn't even hear about it until a month after the fact. A colleague of mine who covers national security was aware of it and thought that someone should write about it, and so it found its way to my desk, and I ended up spending several months looking into it and figuring out the hows and the whys and who was involved, and writing a long-form story for the Post several months after the fact.
And this is in 2012, the break-in at the facility at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which is the place that actually did the uranium enrichment for American bombs for a long time, didn't it?
Yeah, Oak Ridge was created overnight during the Manhattan Project. You know, it's about 30 minutes outside of Knoxville, Tennessee. It was created in the 40s because we were creating secret cities all across the United States to aid the development of the atomic bomb for the Manhattan Project. And Oak Ridge's task was to enrich the uranium for the bomb. And the uranium that was enriched in Oak Ridge was used in the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. And, you know, fast forward from 1945 to 2012, obviously Oak Ridge is still there and the site is still there, still doing work for the nuclear arsenal. And these three activists intruded onto the site in the middle of the night 4 years ago this month to prove several points, and the foremost being that the U.S. should not even possess these nuclear weapons.
How much nuclear weaponry is there in the world today? How many countries are considered part of the nuclear club?
Well, there are nine countries that are considered part of the nuclear club now. In terms of total number of warheads on the planet, we're somewhere in the 15,000s right now. And, of course, the vast majority of those weapons are possessed by the United States and by Russia. But there are seven other countries that have an arsenal of some number. And, of course, a chief concern of the past year has been preventing a tenth member of that club by negotiating with Iran.
All right, we can get to the Iran stuff later. There's a lot of people to know in the history end of this book. Selig Hecht is one of the names that comes into the book. Who is this person?
Yeah, he's someone that most people would not know. He was a biophysicist at Columbia University during the early part of the 20th century. He was there on the faculty when the Manhattan Project was doing work in the basement of the physics building at Columbia. Now, he was not directly involved with work on the atom and work with fission. But he was around faculty members who were. And the reason why he's in the first chapter of the book is because he was the next-door neighbor of Sister Megan Rice, who was one of the three people who broke into this facility in 2012. And she remembers as a young girl hearing adults and hearing her neighbor chatter and murmur about this secret work on the atom that was happening. And that made an impression on her. And she draws a direct connection between growing up during the Manhattan Project on the Upper West Side or in Morningside Heights in Manhattan, and being aware of the secrecy all the way decades later to her deciding to commit this very bold and some might say reckless act of breaking into a nuclear weapons facility.
How much was her position encouraged by the likes of Selig Hecht? I mean, how much did he speak out about nuclear weaponry?
Well, he was he liked to wrangle science with philosophy, and he was published essays, and he wrote a book called Explaining the Atom. He thought, you know, after the bombs were dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the public was aware of this power, that someone needed to write a book that explained the science behind it to people. He thought that people could only be intelligent voters if they were aware of how something like this worked. So he was very mindful that, science meant nothing if it was not made to be understandable for the public. So it's not like he was giving speeches to Sister Meagan, but he represented to her the nature of the secrecy that was pervasive in the area she was growing up. And it was really the kind of the beginning of a lifelong education and a lifelong activism on her part.
The secrecy is a big part of this, which is still impressed upon me, that at the time that Sister Meagan was growing up in Manhattan, this is the time of loose lips sink ships. You don't talk about anything going on with the American war effort. How different was her attitude then, or did it turn into something different later?
Well, you know, at that time during the Manhattan Project, a large portion of the country, different cities, tens of thousands of people, were kind of doing the work without asking what they were doing. There was a significant percentage of people who didn't even know they were working to develop a bomb. It was so secret. So the secrecy was really the thing that first caught her attention. She remembers thinking as a young girl in Manhattan that something so secret could not be good, you know, that there's something nefarious about keeping the public's knowledge from something. And so that unease with the secrecy is what motivated her to essentially study this issue throughout her life. And then what amplified it was one of her uncles was actually deployed to Nagasaki after the bomb was dropped. So he saw the rubble. He was in charge of the American occupying forces. In the aftermath of this detonation, he saw things that were unforgettable, and he came back a changed man. And so she saw a member of her own family dealing with what she called the incredible weight of knowing. And that made a huge impression upon her that has lasted throughout her life.
Uncle Walter, one of many people mentioned in the book, Almighty, Courage, Resistance, and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age by Dan Zak. He's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk much more about nuclear weapons and the nuclear age and people's reactions to it when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking with Dan Zak, Washington Post reporter and newly minted author. His book, due out tomorrow, is called Almighty, Courage, Resistance, and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age, in which he knits together a bunch of stories about people involved with the creation of nuclear weapons, the protesting of nuclear weapons, the proliferation of nuclear weapons. All these characters show up in the book Almighty, and you can be one of the characters who joins the discussion here on the Jefferson Exchange. Lots of people with lots of thoughts about nuclear weapons and their use and their even possession and existence on the planet. Still a very controversial topic. Feel free to join us on the exchange with your thoughts at 800-838-3760 by phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. So I want to come back to this, the fact that Sister Meagan Rice, well, she became Sister Meagan Rice later on, but her uncle Walter came back from seeing Nagasaki, a changed man. And you'd mentioned that people worked on the atomic weapons, Zak, without even knowing. So was there a moment of revelation where a lot of people who'd been involved in creating the materials used in the first two atomic bombs realized that, oh, my God, that's what I've been working on all this time?
Yeah, and the revelation was when they heard on the radio or saw the newspapers after the Hiroshima bombing. I mean, the people, the 30,000 people in Oak Ridge, you know, the vast majority were not aware of what they were working on. And so their introduction was the radio and then gossip spreading and then the newspapers saying, you know, there was one newspaper in East Tennessee that said the headline was Oak Ridge Attacks Japanese. And so that kind of put it very starkly that what they were doing was creating this new kind of weaponry that was then quickly credited with ending World War II. You know, a lot of people, I've talked to some people whose older relatives thought they were working on making ice cream, you know, that the dials they were turning were manufacturing ice cream. Most people had no idea until the news broke.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. And so again, Oak Ridge, why? So we go six decades forward in time, and then there's Meegan in Tennessee with two other protesters breaking into this facility where uranium was enriched. I mean, there are so many targets that protesters have chosen over the years, particularly Plowshares, which is whom they were attached to. Why Oak Ridge, and why then?
They were protesting a planned new facility at this site. This Y-12 site, which has existed since the Manhattan Project, you know, there are plenty of old buildings there, buildings that date to the Manhattan Project, to the 40s, that are falling apart. And the site is trying to reduce its footprint, its square footage, and move operations into newer state-of-the-art buildings. And so one of the reasons that they picked the site was because there's still planned, what's called a uranium processing facility, which is going to cost at least $6 billion, although some people estimate that with delays and cost overruns, it's going to cost $20 billion. And Sister Meegan and her compatriots object to this, what essentially amounts to a reinvestment in operations there. And they think that money could be put to better use. So apart from just kind of the higher altitude objection to nuclear weapons in general, this break-in was an act of protest against this specific construction project.
By any person's guess at security at a place like this, what should have happened once inside the fence, and I should add first fence?
What should have happened?
Yeah.
They should have been detected and apprehended, you would think. The first fence they got past was just a boundary fence, so it was not wired with any kind of sensors. But there were three fences that they cut through that were wired for sensors, and they did set off alarms. The problem is at this facility at that time, the security apparatus was accustomed to a thousand plus false alarms per day, caused by wildlife, caused by foliage, caused by a breeze, the wind. And so there was this culture that, you know, if an alarm goes off, it's probably a false alarm. And so there was a lack of urgency, even though that the alarms that they were setting off were showing a pathway of intrusion. You know, the one fence is cut here, the next fence is cut there, the next fence is cut there. But there was no aggressive reaction to what seemed like a pathway of intrusion. And so they were able to get clear through what's referred to as kind of the inner sanctum of the site. The site's known as the Fort Knox of Uranium. And they walked right up to this storage facility with all this uranium and spray-painted biblical messages and sprinkled blood, and then essentially waited to be apprehended. So even when they got there and they were spray painting and they were chipping away at the corner of this building to symbolically disarm it, you know, the guards up in the turrets thought it was, oh, it must be just a construction crew working overnight. So there was this kind of laxness and this lack of urgency from start to finish here that allowed them to kind of waltz in.
We're talking to Dan Zak about his book, Almighty Courage, Resistance, and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age. So let's take a macro view to widen out from just this incident at Oak Ridge. There have been many acts of civil disobedience around nuclear sites. Can you give us a general sketch of the kinds of things that have been done?
Yeah, I mean, this can go all the way back to, the 1940s, when you had someone like Dorothy Day, the co-founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, writing essays against nuclear weapons, starting right after they were used. You know, we're talking in the winter of 1945 and in 1946. And she would go on to protest every year a defense drill that was held in New York City, where citizens were supposed to take cover because the U.S. was trying to drill for a nuclear attack, and she refused to. And she would stand out in the open with signs and be arrested because she was not complying with this drill. This continues on through the 60s and the 70s with the Berrigan brothers, Philip and Daniel Berrigan, who in 1980 kind of inaugurated this type of civil resistance, what's known as the Plowshares Action, the Plowshares Movement. In 1980, they broke into a nuclear weapons facility in Pennsylvania, and they started a tradition where every couple of years since, a group of activists has done this very thing, and the most recent of which is the one I write about in this book, which is 4 years ago this month, a break-in in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. So there is a long history of activism, but only since 1980 did the Berrigans and their compatriots introduce this more aggressive style of protest, which actually involves trespassing and breaking and entering and damaging missile cones or submarines or buildings, not to sabotage or cause mayhem or destruction, but to prove, in a sense, that there was there's no such thing as security as long as these weapons exist. And Sister Megan and her compatriots Michael and Greg were carrying on that tradition of civil resistance in 2012.
So, and it's a very symbolic thing too, with the hammers to beat the swords into plowshares. So, was there ever serious damage to weapon systems or their components, and serious charges for some of the protesters, obviously, over time?
Yeah, you would think, given the what they were charged with, that there was serious damage. They were charged with intending to endanger the national defense, which is a serious charge. It can carry up to 20 years in prison. It's rooted in the sabotage chapter of the U.S. Criminal Code. The extent of the damage from the break-in was chain links in fences that were cut, some wires that were severed, of course, spray paint and blood on the outside of the building, and then they chipped some chunks off of the corner of one of the turrets of the building, which, as you mentioned, is a symbolic thing. They want to take the prophet Isaiah's words about beating swords into plowshares and actually, start to do that. So, the U.S. estimated that they caused about $50,000 in damage, and that involves physical damage as well as the labor that was needed to make some repairs. But, they never got into the building, nor did they want to. They were never looking to cause any great harm or destruction. But, of course, the U.S. government didn't quite see it that simply.
Were any of the protesters ever hurt seriously? Was lethal force ever used against them?
No, there never has been. Of course, there are people who say if during this particular action, these three had been spotted so close that they were in a zone of this site where lethal force was authorized, and that's the case in many of these actions over the years. So there certainly is an element of danger, and when each activist is considering whether or not to do this type of action, they go on retreat and they confront themselves with the real possibility that they themselves could die during that, and are they really willing to risk their lives and other people's lives to do something for what they believe in.
Washington Post reporter Dan Zak is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the author of a brand spanking new book called Almighty: Courage, Resistance, and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age. One of the key events in the book is the 4 years ago this month break-in at Y-12, a facility handling nuclear materials for the federal government at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, led by Sister Megan Rice. That is one of the key components of the book, but you have some thoughts as well about nuclear weapons and how they've been used in the world and how they've been threatened to be used in the world. Let's get your thoughts about nuclear weaponry and protests. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. There's a lot more history here and a whole bunch more people. John Hendricks, who lived and died around Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Interesting guy on a number of levels, but a bit of a prophecy there. What was it that he saw coming in the future, Dan?
Yeah, he was a resident of the area that became Oak Ridge, that would become Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which would be 30 minutes outside Knoxville. But around the turn of the century, he was known as a local eccentric who claimed to hear voices, who claimed to hear the voice of God, and it's a somewhat apocryphal story that is part of Oak Ridge's accepted history, that this guy, way back in 1900, saw a vision when he went out into the woods and was told that there would be a great city that's built in that location, and it would aid in winning the greatest war ever known, and that there'd be a valley full of rumbling buildings and industrial efforts. And, lo and behold, about 42 years later, the city of Oak Ridge is created overnight by the U.S. government to aid in the Manhattan Project. And so the city, even today, that's part of the story it tells itself, that its existence was prophesized by this guy way back in 1900, that a whole city would be created and help win a world war.
Why there? Did Tennessee have a powerful senator or something?
That's one of it. Yeah, they had a powerful senator who was privy to the great industrial effort that was needed, and was in talks with President Roosevelt, saying, he would love to have this type of money flowing into his state. But it was also chosen because Eastern Tennessee has a ridge and valley topography, And the administrators of the Manhattan Project saw that topography as useful because they could put different plants, different factories in different valleys. And if something went really wrong, the topography would contain any bad things that were to happen just by virtue of the hills and valleys. So the other reason is because the Tennessee Valley Authority was all around. There was a electrical dam nearby. There was an abundant source of water and power. This was a city that contained facilities that used a significant percentage of electricity of the U.S. at the time it was operating. So there was a variety of factors that contributed to East Tennessee being chosen.
So why was this facility that Sister Megan and her companions broke into called Y-12, and how much did it cost it to set that place up?
Well, Y-12, no one really knows why it was called that. There were other sites that were part of the Manhattan Project that were called X-10 and K-25, but there was no particular reason why the letter Y and the number 12 were part of this facility's name. This was a vast effort. I mean, they had to build some of the biggest buildings ever built in order to enrich uranium through various methods in Oak Ridge. You know, we're talking, all told for the Manhattan Project, billions of dollars. I mean, you could still rank it as probably the greatest industrial effort in human history by many standards. And a lot of that effort was happening in Oak Ridge. They had to import tens of thousands of people, machinists and clerks and secretaries and physicists. They had to build buildings overnight and factories in short order and essentially set up this thriving and humming city in order to enrich the uranium, this kind of piecemeal, a very gradual but huge industrial process. And they were on a race against the clock, so it had to be in fast. You know, the U.S. was doing this so that they would have the atomic bomb before the Third Reich did. And so it was a hub of incredible activity, incredible money, incredible effort for 18 months around the clock.
Dan Zak is our guest on The Exchange. His book is Almighty. But did the work, I mean, there was still activity there at Oak Ridge, I mean, involved in building new nuclear weapons after the war. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, there's always been a mission related to the nuclear arsenal in Oak Ridge since the end of World War II. And, of course, during the Cold War, the facility there did work on machining parts for the weapons. It has done work then and continues to do work now on the component of the nuclear weapon that turns it into a thermonuclear weapon. So the component that makes the bomb even more powerful, that is a component that is machined and maintained and refurbished in Oak Ridge even still. So there's always been a mission. Of course, in more recent years, the mission has diversified. There's a lot of work on medical isotopes and work on the atom that does not kind of involve preparation for war or war making. But the arsenal, it's still very much a site that is integral to the maintenance and processing of the current arsenal.
Let's talk about the current arsenal. How quickly did it grow in the days after World War II as we settled into a Cold War with the Soviets?
It grew very quickly. At some point in the 60s, we had tens of thousands of them. And Russia's grew, or Soviet Union's grew alongside that as well. There's been a significant reduction in the number of warheads since then, since the peak stockpile, an 85% reduction. So there has been an enormous amount of work done over the years, especially since the Cold War, to reduce the volume of these warheads. But, the world still has enough to end the world multiple times over. And we're about to embark on a very costly modernization of the remaining nuclear arsenal. So you could argue that while we've been pretty good about cutting down the numbers, they're not as low as they should be, and we're about to preserve them for decades to come.
There are pictures in the book, including of that a couple of famous tests of nuclear weapons, like the ones in the Pacific, which makes me wonder, I mean, how much of the visible public testing was quality control and how much of it was meant to scare the Soviets?
Well, it was definitely both, I think in equal parts. you know, this was a science that, that we spent, and we still are trying to understand. I mean, we still do subcritical testing in Nevada. We still have national labs that are studying nuclear detonations on computers digitally. So these tests that we did, you know, throughout the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, into the 80s, we're all trying to understand this reaction and to improve the weapons themselves. Of course, you know, when you detonate a 15 megaton bomb in the middle of the Pacific, I think you're testing both the limits of what the destructive force can be, but also, you know, the light from that bomb was seen thousands of miles away in Japan. So you are also, it's a very explosive way to send a message to other superpowers, namely the Soviet Union at the time, that, you know, if they're developing really and ever more powerful weapons, then so are we.
So the plowshares people have certainly observed the 85% reduction in nuclear arsenal. Do they want it to zero? Is that their stated goal?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there's a range of activists, and some recognize that you know, immediately getting rid of our own nuclear weapons is not only impossible, but could be imprudent. But yeah, I mean, if you're talking about plowshares activists, they want to see zero nuclear weapons. Many would say that it doesn't matter what other countries are doing, we should get rid of ours. Of course, that's a non-starter for the U.S. government and military. But yeah, they view these weapons as not only immoral, which is one argument, but also illegal, that they, as used in war, do not distinguish between military and civilians, and therefore are against things like the Geneva Protocol and international standards in war making.
A lot more to talk about with Dan Zak about his book on nuclear weapons and our responses to them. His book is called Almighty. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange, and if you'd like to join us, we'll hear from you too when we come back to the Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Washington Post correspondent Dan Zak, the author of a new book called Almighty: Courage, Resistance, and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age. The dust jacket is a picture of one of the explosions we were just talking about, a test of nuclear weaponry in the Pacific with a huge mushroom cloud coming up out of the ocean itself. These are the fears that people lived with for decades in America, largely until the collapse of the Soviet Union 25 years ago. The nuclear weapons still exist. There are 85% fewer of them, perhaps, but they still exist, and people still have concerns about them, including Sister Megan Rice, who with two other people broke into a highly secure federal facility in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, 4 years ago this month, to get the point across that they really would like to see nuclear weapons come to an end. Let's get your thoughts on the process, the weapons, the opposition to them, or any of that. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned the Berrigan brothers already and some of the other major names of the nuclear resistance movement. Daniel Ellsberg, who later leaked the Pentagon Papers, what turned him against nuclear weapons, Dan?
Well, when he was working, you know, this is before the Pentagon Papers, when he was working in the Defense Department, you know, he was privy to the plans that were drawn up, you know, for nuclear war fighting. And he was wondering, you know, what the Joint Chiefs of Staff estimated for global fatalities if such a plan was carried out. And this plan was a massive nuclear first strike against Soviet and Chinese targets. And the answer he was given on a sheet of paper marked top secret is that the estimate was 600 million fatalities if that plan was carried out. And he thought that was madness, absolute madness, that was actually, you know, part of military planning. And so that turned him against nuclear weapons in the early days of the JFK administration.
Was he the one who coined the term mutually assured destruction, or MAD? Or was that just a...
Was he the one?
Yeah.
You know, I'm actually not sure if there was an individual who did. I'm sure there was, and I should know that. But I think that was just a result of that very kind of planning, that this was so inconceivable that because it would happen, that would prevent it from happening. The horror of it is what would keep the peace, and it's kind of the paradox at the center of nuclear weapons even today, that people think we preserve the world by threatening its extinction minute to minute.
So deterrence comes from fear, from thinking that if we release our missiles, they're certainly going to release theirs, and so everybody's going to get bombed.
Exactly.
Wow. How close did we come to nuclear war by anyone's estimation in the Cuban Missile Crisis or at any time since?
Well, there's been several incidents, both high profile and not high profile, of getting very, very close. I mean, obviously everyone knows about the Cuban Missile Crisis. There was an incident in 1983 where the Soviet advance warning military officials were aware or became aware of an alarm that told them that there was an incoming volley of U.S. Nuclear missiles. That turned out not to be the case. It was sunlight that was reflecting off clouds that was interpreted by radar, Soviet radar, as an incoming attack. But that decision fell to one man who was in one of the bunkers outside Moscow. And if he had kind of followed the prescription of these alarms, he would have run that up the chain and the Soviets would have launched their arsenal when there was really none coming at them. And that's just one example of accident or near accident and near miscalculation that the world has lived under since the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Has there been a lot of revising of procedures since those days, since the Cuban Missile Crisis alone, for example, just in terms of making sure that we know exactly what we're dealing with before anybody starts giving launch codes out?
Yeah, I mean, starting right after the Cuban Missile Crisis, that's where we get the red phone from. You know, to avoid a misunderstanding, the leader of the Soviet Union and the leader of the U.S. needed to be able to talk to each other directly instead of through a complicated military bureaucracy or not at all, so that they could avoid the type of misunderstanding that led to the Cuban Missile Crisis. And since then, there have been a kind of more bureaucratic steps that are taken to make sure that nuclear war isn't as possible as it could be, and that includes reducing stockpiles, removing nuclear warheads from other countries. We used to have deploy Pershing 2 missiles in Eastern Europe, and we removed those to kind of de-escalate the risk of regional nuclear war. And there's talk these days about de-alerting our nuclear forces. You know, right now we have 4,000 deployed warheads, and some of them are on what's called prompt launch, although some call it hair trigger warning, which is they're ready to go if we detect some kind of incoming nuclear attack. And people think, you know, hair trigger alert, prompt launch is something that should go away with the Cold War, that we need to de-alert these weapons.
So it seems like there's less concern between countries over time about an exchange of nuclear weapons, but now we live in the age of large-scale terrorist attacks. And so what have the nuclear powers done to beef up security, which is obviously one of the issues that crops up with Megan Rice and the protesters at Oak Ridge?
Yeah, exactly. It goes back to that what if. You know, what if they weren't, you know, part of the Plowshares movement, pacifists that were just trying to make a point? And people who are against the possession or the large-scale possession of nuclear weapons say they serve no purpose in a world that has moved beyond the Cold War. They serve no purpose in a world that seems to be most threatened by multipolar and terrorism and fighting against forces that do not have a nation state and do not have a nuclear arsenal. And so the preeminent concern should be preventing these forces from obtaining nuclear material that they could rig into some device that causes mass mayhem or disruption. And the continued focus and continued monetary investment in a volume of weapons that were only potentially useful in the context of the Cold War is useless at this point in time.
So on that July morning at Oak Ridge, I mean, how long before security caught up with Megan Rice and her fellow protesters?
They definitely had minutes. I think it's hard to estimate exactly without kind of having all the security footage, which is impossible. The government granted me, I think, 51 seconds of the security footage, and that was it. And that was after they were already on the ground being handcuffed. But they were within the bounds of this inner sanctum for about 20 minutes. That's what I've been able to estimate before they were apprehended, which means they essentially were kind of waiting to be arrested. You know, they were able to spray paint more messages than they thought they would before a single lone guard was dispatched and showed up and saw this this trio there.
So it's interesting too to see where things went after this. Congress actually subpoenaed Megan Rice.
Well, they had hearings, and because Sister Megan and her compatriot Michael Wally are, you know, intensely interested in this topic, they attended the hearings just as members of the audience. And because they were there, they were thanked by some people in Congress. You know, they were identified and praised for exposing these security flaws. And then there were other members of Congress who said, "What are they even doing here? How are they even free? They broke into the what's supposed to be one of the most secure facilities, a very very serious facility, and they're sitting here in the audience. That's that. All right." So Congress had kind of a mixed reaction to that. But what was shared among them was an outrage that this was even allowed to happen.
Hmm. Her trial, Sister Megan's trial in Tennessee, was not the first of its kind. Had there been a bunch of previous protests similar to this at Oak Ridge?
At Oak Ridge, yes. Nothing that was that went this far, though. There have been kind of ritualistic line crossings, you know, a protest that amasses at the boundary of the site, and then, you know, the ritual stepping over the boundary into the arms of waiting law enforcement, and it's kind of just a symbolic peaceful thing. This was the first time of where the action had this kind of magnitude and this kind of effect, and they got this far. They weren't just stepping over a line. They were stepping over the line, cutting through fences, hiking over a wooded ridge, and reaching this this facility, which holds our highly enriched uranium.
You had mentioned about some of the lapses in security there and the fact that they were getting many false alarms. Has the security system had a wholesale change since the break-in 4 years ago?
There have been improvements. The contractors who run the site have said that there's been, you know, smaller but significant improvements, like more concertina wire, more razor wire everywhere. The security force was retrained within a week or two of the intrusion, and new protocols for maintenance issues were issued. You know, no longer could a maintenance issue like a camera, a security camera that wasn't operating, could go before it could go months without being fixed. Now everything has to be addressed within hours. And so false alarms were cut by a great percentage. And so there was tightening up of security in the aftermath.
What kind of sentence did Megan get?
She got about 2 years, I think, 2 or 3 years. I think almost 3 years. I think it was 2 years and 11 months. And the two gentlemen, Michael and Greg, who committed this act with her, got, I think, between 5 and 6 years because they had a longer rap sheet. They had done more protests before, including other Plowshares actions themselves. This was Sister Megan's first Plowshares action. So it differed between them.
As you point out in the book, I mean, the Plowshares people are the ones who make it most public now, but the opposition to nuclear weapons has been so pronounced throughout the history of our even working on them before they were truly usable. In fact, you write about scientists involved in the process, and the Manhattan Project wrote a petition to the president at one point. What did it say?
Yeah, well, it said we understand the destructive value of this, the immensity of what this weapon can do should be demonstrated first publicly to alert the world that we have this potential now rather than just used in combat. I mean, we the bomb that we dropped on Hiroshima, we didn't even test first. The test that we did in New Mexico, actually 71 years ago this Saturday, was a Nagasaki-style bomb, which exploded differently. It was an implosion bomb. The one we dropped on Hiroshima, we never even really tested. It was a gun-type uranium bomb. We just dropped it, and we knew the science was such that it would work. And these scientists thought that, well, maybe we should make the demonstration, the test, public first, and say, there's this new technology. It makes war unthinkable at this point. Let's end this world war. Japan surrender, and we won't use it. But instead, we used it.
And in fact, there was some discussion, I think, at the Manhattan Project about letting the Japanese come view the test.
Yeah, exactly. That's what a lot of scientists, not all, but a lot, wanted to do. And I think they were aware at this point that their intellectual efforts and their exploration of this science, of this physics, was headed toward an end that would see the suffering of a great many people, let alone the end of a world war. And so they were very conflicted about that, and they wanted to make sure that the president knew that this was a recommendation of a group of them.
Well, and we certainly are aware of what happened after that. There's the long-argued point about American lives potentially saved by using the bombs at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. What was the War Department's assessment about when Japan likely would have surrendered even without the use of the A-bombs?
You know, there was a report that was issued just a year, less than a year, after Japan was bombed and surrendered, that even without the atomic bombs, Japan would have surrendered unconditionally by that November, which is when the U.S. was purportedly planning a land invasion. And so it was the U.S. government's estimation that if we had not dropped the bombs, the war still would have been over. Of course, there are plenty of people who say that, you know, the world was fatigued after so many years of the bloodiest war in history, that something dramatic had to be done to stop it. And this was the thing. And this is the thing that prevented all of the U.S. servicemen who were waiting in the Pacific for this land invasion. This is what saved them and allowed them to go back to their families or start families. And there are plenty of people who have relatives who were in that position who look at the droppings of the atomic bombs as the thing that saved them.
Dan, I'm sure your book was already off the press and probably sitting in boxes waiting to ship when President Obama visited Hiroshima. What were your impressions of what happened there?
Yeah, it was. I mean, that was a big deal. The first sitting president to visit Hiroshima, and he is a president who, more than his immediate predecessors, just has had nuclear weapons at the forefront of his mind. I mean, going back to when he was in college at Columbia, he was there in school when a million people marched into Central Park against the Reagan arms buildup and against the heightened tensions with the Soviet Union. One of his senior papers was on nuclear relations with the Soviet Union and non-proliferation. So this is something he's thought about over the years. He visited former Soviet sites when he was a senator, and he talked about the specter of undersecured nuclear materials that was still in existence in 2006, 2007. And then, of course, the first speech that he makes abroad when he becomes president in 2009 is about seeking the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons. He's demonstrated an awareness of this over the years.
All right. Very much the topic of the book, Almighty, Courage, Resistance, and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age by Dan Zak. Dan, thanks for joining us.